everybody.
Amen.
Did anybody not get a handout? All right, good. We did good. We are continuing our study tonight on the feast, festivals, and holy days of Israel. Tonight, we are going to do a second lesson on the Passover. And as I said last week, my plan is to do three lessons on Passover, being one of the most significant of the feasts. I feel like it is due some extra time. And tonight's lesson is going to focus on the meal known as the Seder. Somebody asked me after service last week, how do you spell that? S-E-D-E-R, and it's in your handout. But this is the meal, the ceremonial meal that is observed during Passover. Now, as I said last week, we're kind of taking two of these things together, Passover and unleavened bread. So last week we looked at, we spent most of our time looking at Exodus 12 and 13 when Passover and unleavened bread were established in preparation for the event with a literal Passover where the hand of God passed over his people. And those instructions that were given to the Israelites to prepare for that evening, they were told to maintain that as a permanent ordinance. And the Passover was going to be maintained as a permanent ordinance on the 14th day of the first month, which is the month of Nisan or Abib. And then beginning on the 15th day and for 7 days, they were going to observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread and have a meal gathering on the first day and the seventh day. And during those 7 days, no leaven was to be consumed. We looked at the details of when that was instituted. And Lord willing, I think we'll do this next Sunday night. If I can get it done, I'll talk. I'm going to be gone all week, and I'll talk about that later. If I can get it done, I plan on doing the next one next Sunday night. Next Sunday night, I want to look at the observance of the Passover in the New Testament, primarily focused on two things. One is the meal that Jesus had with his disciples in the upper room. Clearly, I think it's John that specifically says this was to observe Passover. But did it occur on Passover? There is some question as to whether or not that was actually the 14th day of Nisan when that happened. And we'll talk about that. That's a much more technical discussion. But then we'll also talk about if it wasn't on the day of Passover, then but they intended to observe it as a Passover meal, what did that mean? But more importantly, I believe, we're going to talk about Jesus as the Passover lamb and Jesus taking the elements, two elements that were at that time a part of the Passover and changing the meaning of those things because of the fulfillment of what the Passover represented coming to pass. Passover was a remembrance of a physical delivery from physical death. As all of these feasts and festivals, it was a shadow of what would be fully realized in a spiritual sense in Jesus, who is a deliverer of us from spiritual death. And Jesus took two of those elements from the Passover and he changed the meaning of them for us as a permanent ordinance going forward in what we call the Lord's Supper. So those are the two things, Lord willing, we'll look at next week. I decided to do this focus on the meal in between the Old Testament lesson and the New Testament lesson primarily because of one thing. And that is when you read about Jesus and his disciples observing the Passover, what is an element that is a part of that that we don't read about in Exodus 12 or 13? The cup. The cup. And so I want to have a conversation about the cup and about the meal that surrounds the cup so that we have a greater understanding of perhaps some of the things that they were observing when they sat down to have the Passover meal. Does that make sense? So this is both to help us understand what the meal consists of, even to today, okay? And then to help us inform what we're going to read about next time when we look at Jesus and his disciples observing the Passover meal. Now, if you look on the handout, The very beginning thing I have on page one is I've got a section called Relevant Jewish Texts. The reason why I want to go through this is, one, because I think it's helpful information just generally in understanding Jewish culture and Jewish religious practice. But also, when we talk about the mystery of the cup, which is going to be our next topic, some of what we're going to talk about comes out of one of these, or actually two of these texts, okay? Now, I've got three of, under relevant Jewish texts, I've got three things listed. I've got the Mishnah, I've got the Gemara, and I've got the Talmud. My guess is that most of you have at least heard of the Mishnah and the Talmud. You probably have never heard of the Gemara, because it is not mentioned very often in today's culture. But we'll talk about why in just a minute. But you, if you've heard of any of these, you probably have heard of the Mishnah and the Talmud. But I wanted us to talk about what those things really are. Now, when Jesus was in his earthly ministry, he had a frequent conflict with the Pharisees, right? We know that. That's not a controversial saying. He had conflict with the Pharisees. And primarily what he had conflict with the Pharisees was his saying that, you know, hey, you're checking all the boxes of, and these are my words, you're checking all the boxes of religion, you're going through the motions, and you're holding them to the nth degree, but you've forgotten about what the real meaning behind all of this is. And what the Pharisees were following were things called the oral traditions. Okay, what are the oral traditions? The oral traditions, sometimes called the oral Torah, were ways of practicing things, supposedly in support of the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, but in many cases added on to what was actually in the first, you know, the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. So there were all these traditions that we don't do this, we do this, we, you know, whatever, that all these things that we practice, but we never write them down. They're only passed on verbally from generation to generation. And in what is referred to many times as the Second Temple period, the Second Temple period ran from from the 6th century BC, so we're counting backwards 600 years BC, okay, from the 6th century BC until 70 AD. What happened in 70 AD? Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. That time period, now, the 6th century, the 500s BC, when Babylon destroyed, conquered Judah, took them captive, but it wasn't until later, until the Persians took over Babylon, the exiles returned home, and they rebuilt the wall and they rebuilt the temple, right? Now, that's when this Second Temple period begins, okay, when Jerusalem is rebuilt. For the next 600 to 700 years, a bunch of things changed with the Jews. The primary thing that happened during that time period is that Palestine came under control of the Roman Empire. And because of that, even though they were back in their homeland, persecution of the Jews intensified. Because they did not control their own territory, They did not control Israel. Just as a little side note, that whole period is known of as the Second Temple period. From the time in which it was rebuilt after they came back from exile until the time it was destroyed in AD 70. However, how many temples were there during that time period? There were two. There were actually three temples total, two during the Second Temple period. So why is it all called the Second Temple period? Well, because during the time of Herod the Great being the one who was in power, the regional Roman ruler who was in power when Jesus was born, he's the one that had all the babies killed. Herod the Great built this magnificent temple mount, and he rebuilt the temple. Okay, he made this, he did this to gain favor with the Jews and to make Jerusalem kind of his show place. So if he rebuilt the temple, why is that still called the second temple period? Because he rebuilt it in such a way where they never had to stop observing religious ceremonies in that area. He would put up temporary walls and they would continue to do their worship. They would continue to observe Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, where the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies. They continued all of those things in the exact same spot while he rebuilt around them. And because they never stopped worshiping in that spot, the Jews do not consider that to be another temple. Does that make sense? To us, you go, well, that's Herod's temple. To them, the temple continued to exist because we continue to worship in that spot. So if you ever hear that, that's free of charge, that little side lesson there. But I say all that to say this. During that time period, the second temple period, the persecution on the Jews began to escalate because the Romans are now in charge. And what had previously been forbidden, which was the writing down of the oral traditions, these must be passed on orally, there began to be discussions of, because of the persecution that we're facing, what happens if we lose these oral traditions? You with me? Well, that came to a head when the temple was destroyed, when Jerusalem was burned to the ground. And that began an effort in earnest to say, all right, we've got to take these things and write them down before they're lost for all time. Okay. And so Jewish rabbis began to compile, write down the oral traditions. And they are written down like examples, like such and such would do this on this day at this time. I mean, if you read it, and I've read, you know, I won't claim to have read most of it. I've read some of it. If you read it, it reads like, here's an example of this particular rabbi doing this thing this way at this time. And here's the next example of this rabbi doing this thing at this time in this way. And that's what they're like. Okay. The compilation of all those oral traditions, the things that Jesus was kind of fighting against during his ministry, were written down, and that was completed by the end of the second century AD and known as the Mishnah. Okay, so if you ever hear of the name the Mishnah is the written down oral traditions, the oral Torah of the Jewish rabbis. Okay, that's what the Mishnah is. Now, the second thing that I have on the list is the Gemara. Hey, the Gemara you can think of as like commentary, analysis and commentary. So once the Mishnah was completed at the end of the second century, rabbis began to pore over the oral traditions of the Jews written down in the Mishnah. They began to pore over it and began to document their commentary, their analysis, their observation on the Mishnah. And over the next 300 years, rabbis in Israel and rabbis in Babylonia recorded their analysis and commentary of the Mishnah. This commentary was compiled into 63 books. Now, there's two different versions of the Gemara, but it was compiled into 63 different books of commentary and analysis of the Mishnah, again known as the Gemara. That was finished by the end of the 5th century, so 300 years later, the end of the 5th century. If you take those two works, the Mishnah and the Gemara, and you put them together, that is the Talmud. The Talmud, okay? And if you look in the handout, I have made this note, the Talmud is the central text of Rabbinic Judaism and the primary source of Jewish religious law and theology. This is the book. Other than the Torah, this is the book that the Jews depend on for their religious tradition, their religious law. And again, we're not talking about a book that's like this big. We're talking about volumes of material, okay? Because the Talmud incorporates both the Mishnah and the Gemara, okay? 63 books of commentary put in with all the text from the Mishnah. Go, well, Tim, why do we go through all that? I'm going to tell you why. Because it was not written down until the end of the second century, some of the things that are in the Mishnah, we don't know when they started, right? because they weren't written down until the second century, but it could be that they date all the way back to 400 years before the time of Jesus, or 500 years before the time of Jesus, because we don't know, because they weren't written down. Okay. Now, the next section, I'm going to get to why in just a second, but the next section I have labeled the mystery of the cup. And just to kind of cut to the chase here, we know that by the time of the New Testament, that when Jesus and his disciples are in the upper room observing the Passover meal, there is a cup. And in Luke's account, Luke talks about two times during the meal that Jesus raised the cup and he made some significant statement about himself or what, you know, what the cup was going to represent moving forward. So by the time of the first century, the cup, at least in their observance of the meal, is a part of the meal. Okay? Now here's where the text come into play. That was in, you know, early part of the first century AD. Now we fast forward to the end of the second century AD, which is when the Mishnah was completed. When the Mishnah was completed, one section of the Mishnah, which I have in bold there, the Mishnah Pesachim, which comes from the Hebrew word Pesach, which is what it means Passover, okay? The Pesachim is an entire book in the Mishnah about how the Passover is to be observed. And in that book, in the 10th, we'll call it chapter, they don't call them chapters, but the 10th chapter in section 1, it specifies that not just one, but four cups are to be used, or the same cup to be refilled four times, okay, during the meal. So, not only was it part of Jesus and his disciples observing their Passover meal, but by the time the oral traditions are written down, the Jews are saying, this is part of the Passover meal. Okay? Ultimately, when and why that happened is a mystery. We do not know, because the oral traditions were not written down until 200 years after the turn of, you know, the turn of the from BC to AD, okay, to the end of the second century AD, okay. So we don't know. Ultimately, we don't know. There's nothing we can specifically point to that go, hey, this was in the Apocrypha, or hey, this was written down by such and such. Because what happens between the Old Testament and the New Testament? We have 400 years of dead period, right? We have no writings, and there's no written history from the Jews. There's no written. The oral traditions were not written down for 200 years after that, so we don't know when they happened. But a couple of things about the four cups, okay? The four cups are specified in the Mishnah, so we know they came into being at some point, and because Jesus used the cup in his observance, likely they began to be being used in the Passover before the time of Jesus. Today, the Jews do not have universal agreement, but there is somewhat of a consensus about what the four cups represent. This is not specified in the Mishnah. This is interpretation of the Mishnah. And I've got it written down there of what they believe the four cups were intended to represent. And so during the meal, during the Passover meal, my understanding is that some Jews will actually have four cups per person and some will have one cup that they refill four times. But during the meal, the cup is sipped four times. And each one of those times is meant to represent a section of the text of Exodus 6:6-7, which is kind of pointing to the deliverance of the Israelites from Egyptian captivity. And so each one is meant to represent a different aspect of the deliverance. Now, if you remember back to Exodus 12, when we looked at last week when this was implemented, they talked about, I mean, God told Moses, you know, when you're observing this meal, tell your children, tell your descendants about why we do this, right? You know, remind them of why we're doing this. Tell them why we're doing this. And this is part of it today, you know, which evolved over time. But the four cups, part of the four cups, the Jews believe was intended to represent God's redemption of Israel from Egypt. So, as an example, the first cup, the cup of, some will say the cup of consecration or the cup of sanctification, they will hold up the cup and they will read from the first part of Exodus 6. I will bring you out. The emphasis on the word bring. All the emphasis is on the verbs, okay? I will bring you out. And then later in the meal, we'll talk about when later when we get to the actual order of the meal, they will hold up the second cup, the cup of judgment, the cup of plagues, and say, I will deliver you, again from Exodus 6:6, the emphasis on deliver. And then the third one, the cup of redemption or blessing, and will say, I will redeem you from Exodus 6:7. And then finally, the cup of praise. Praise in Hebrew is hallel. It's where we get our word hallelujah. Hallel, praise. Yah, Jah means God. Hallelujah, praise God. Hallel is Hebrew for praise. I will take you for my people. So the cups are raised four times during the meal. And these sections of Exodus 6, verses 6 and 7 are quoted. Now I ask a question at the bottom though. So how did we get from the cup's not mentioned, the cup is not mentioned in Exodus 12 and 13, but Jesus uses the cup and the Mishnah mentions that there should be four cups. How do we get from it's not mentioned to it's an integral part of the Passover meal? And as I've already said, we don't know. We really don't know. But you flip over, there are some theories, okay? Some theories. Now, I've written down two of these theories. This is not, look at me, this is not an exhaustive list, okay? If I had written all the theories that are out there on handouts, I would not have enough paper in the building to print them out. I just want to give you two examples of theories about where this tradition may have come from, or this being part of the meal. The first one I've written down is Roman influence, okay? Now, I mentioned that during the Second Temple period, the Romans, Israel came under the Roman Empire, okay? And so clearly, there are things, customs, traditions of the Romans that influence the Jews. I mean, you can't help but be influenced by those you're around. So one theory is that a Roman tradition was an almost ceremonial use of the cup, wine, during a formal banquet-type meal that they called symposiums. Okay, now we may have a different, slightly different meaning of the word symposium in English today, but if you look there, symposium literally means to get together to drink wine. That's what symposium means, okay? So, Kate, when you went to Harding last summer for symposium, that's what you were supposed to do. I'm kidding. But that's literally what symposium means. And so I'm not going to just read this verbatim to you, but essentially they would have a period of getting together before the meal, and they would observe a cup of wine together. And then they would go into the place of the meal, and they would have another cup together during the meal. And then after the meal, they would enjoy a cup after the meal, in, you know, observing that the meal is over. And some are speculating that that tradition was picked up by the rabbis, who then added a cup at the end, and adopted it as their own. Okay? Again, maybe, maybe not. I have no idea. Okay? Another theory is that this goes way back, way further back than the Roman Empire, back to the time of Melchizedek. If you don't remember Melchizedek, there's not much said about Melchizedek. Melchizedek is identified as the king of Salem who encounters Abram back in Genesis. And when Melchizedek encounters Abram, he comes to him with bread and wine. And some have said, well, that began the tradition of any time there is a, quote, holy meal, that wine must be present. And so over time, because Passover is a holy meal, then inevitably wine was added as part of the observance of Passover. Again, two theories out of hundreds. But ultimately, it's a mystery. We don't know when it started. We don't know why it started. But by the time of the New Testament, it's there. Okay? And Jesus takes that as an opportunity to say, here's what this is going to mean for you going forward. Okay? So, with that out of the way, that gets us through the mystery of the cup, which is still unsolved. We don't know why it happened. But I mentioned that the meal that's observed on the day of Passover, beginning the night of the 14th day of the first month, the month of Nisan or Abib, the Passover meal. What I want to do is I want to go through the preparation for the meal, and then the order of the meal. Okay, now I want to tell you this, that what I'm going through is not, all elements of this are not universally observed by all Jews. Not then, not today. Okay, this is just meant as an example of what a Seder meal can look like. Okay, that incorporates some of the elements that were prescribed in Exodus 12. Okay, so one of the things that we're going to talk about, the preparation for the meal. One of the things that is clearly specified in Exodus 12 and 13 is that there is to be no leaven in the house, right? And in the Mishnah, it gets very specific about the procedure for making sure that there's no leaven in the house. I put down a few things there, but the father of the house is supposed to use a feather and a spoon to sweep up any last bit of shametz, which is the Hebrew word for yeast or leaven, anywhere in the house, to use a feather and a spoon. Why a feather and a spoon? I don't know. But apparently a dustbuster is not appropriate, so you use a feather and a spoon to sweep up any last bit of leaven that's in the house. The Mishnah, and this is in Pisachim, which sounds like a Pokemon, Pisachim, yeah. The Pisachim, this is in chapter 1, verse 1. This is a big book. Just the one on how to observe Passover. It's huge. It's huge. But in chapter 1, verse 1, it specifies that any dark areas of the house are to be searched for leaven with a candle. If you've got an area where you can't get light, the daylight doesn't hit, and it's dark, you're supposed to take a candle and illuminate every part of the house so you can find the leaven. Today, during Passover and unleavened bread, only foods with no yeast are eaten. The most well-known unleavened food is the bread matzah, which, by the way, is in most churches that observe the Lord's Supper. We use matzah. One of the things that was interesting about all the years I was associated with Gospel Advocate, we sold tons of matzah bread. Okay, but everyone that we sold was stamped with a little logo that said not for Passover use. You know why? There's nothing different about the bread, but they had in their factory where they produced this, they had one section that was blessed by the rabbis and one section that was not. And it was cheaper to get the ones that were not blessed by the rabbis. And that's the difference. If it was blessed by the rabbi, it got the sticker, and if it was blessed by the rabbi, it got the sticker that it could be used for Passover, and if it wasn't, it got the sticker that it couldn't be used for Passover, okay? But it's all unleavened bread, matzah, unleavened bread. So the same matzah that we generally use for the, I don't know what our little chiclet things are that we use today, but it's some type of unleavened bread. But matzah bread that we use in, most churches use in the Lord's Supper today is the same kind of matzah that is used in Passover, okay? Looks like a large cracker, has no leaven in it. And we'll talk more about that in just a minute, okay? The head of the household wears a kittel. Now, that is a ceremonial robe that they put on to lead the family through the Passover. They put on the ceremonial robe and they lead the family through the Passover. So they will put on the robe at the beginning of the meal. The table is set with the following items. Today, this would likely have not been the case during the time of Jesus. But today, if you were to see a Jewish family observing the Passover, they would have an actual cedar plate. Again, S-E-D-E-R, plate. And that plate has six areas. And the picture that I have in the handout has got a plate with little six things like scooped out, almost like an egg tray, okay? And the six things from in clockwise order, beginning at the 12 o'clock one, okay? The rest of this lesson is going to have a ton of Hebrew words. I may or may not try to pronounce them all because I'm going to mess them up if I do. But the very first thing at the top of the plate, 12 o'clock, bitter herbs or lettuce. Why bitter herbs? That's what's specified in Exodus chapter 12. With the lamb, you have bitter herbs, okay? The next, going to the right clockwise, you have a shank bone, lamb or roasted chicken leg. Why a shank bone today? Because there's no temple. Remember how we talked about last week that over time, the Passover evolved to where the Passover lamb was obtained by the family from the temple, Okay? Well, they don't have a temple today, so the shank bone is placed on the plate in lieu of the Passover lamb. Then in the next lot, you have a mixture of nuts, fruit, wine, and spices. In the fourth position, you have more bitter herbs, typically horseradish. And then you have parsley or other vegetables. And finally, a roasted hard-boiled egg. This is all on the cedar plate. This is not the entirety of the meal. This is the ceremonial part of the meal. Okay, but they will go through each one of these as part of the meal. They will also, in addition to the cedar plate, will have a covered plate. This is one for the table. A covered plate that has three large pieces of matzah bread in it, stacked on top of each other, wrapped in a napkin, okay? But in the table and stacked on top of each other. They will have a bowl of salt water and at least one wine glass for each person. As I mentioned, some will do four, but at least one wine glass for each person. Now, this next one is one that some do and some don't. And that is, in some families today, they will have an extra cup for Elijah. Remember what we talked about this morning, that one of the theories about who Jesus was is that he was Elijah? And that comes from Malachi chapter 4, and the prophecy that people interpret to be that Elijah would precede the Messiah coming back. And so since the Jews do not believe, Elijah would precede the Messiah's arrival, and I believe that was a prophecy concerning John the Baptist. But the Jews today, who do not believe that Jesus was the Messiah, believe that in order for Messiah to come, Elijah must come first. And so they will leave a place for Elijah. And that comes from not the Mishnah, but the Talmud. Okay, what's the Talmud? The Talmud has the Gemara in it, which is the commentary. And so this comes from rabbinic commentary on the Mishnah that, you know, some interpret to say, leave a place set for Elijah, okay? Because he has to come back before the Messiah can come back. And I didn't put this in the handout, but I've even read that some families will leave the door open to the home so that Elijah can come back, okay? So that's the preparation. Now, I don't have this in there, but one of the things that's in the Mishnah that there's a difference today, I clearly would have been followed by Jesus and his disciples because that was the traditional way that they sat. But the Mishnah specifies that regardless of how you sit any other time of the year for a meal, that for the Passover, you are to sit on the ground, leaning on your left side. Okay, that is in the Mishnah. Less Orthodox Jewish families today will use chairs. Okay. But you would know if it was a more Orthodox family if they were actually sitting on the ground and laying on their side. Now, very likely that Jesus and his disciples were sitting on the ground because that's the traditional way that they ate. Okay, but I just wanted to give you that as a difference you might see if you knew a Jewish family today. Now, last thing before they begin the meal is that the women of the household will light two candles in honor of the holiness of the day and recite a blessing for the family before they observe the meal. Okay? That is the last step before they begin the meal. Now, if you flip over, I'm going to try to go through this pretty quickly. But they start off with, this is, again, not all elements are followed by all people, all Jews. And this is not going to be 100% representative of what Jesus went through, but this is an example of a cedar meal with all the ceremony that's a part of it. They will begin with reciting a blessing and drinking the first cup of wine. Okay, so again, it's either the first cup or they drink the cup and refill it. Then ritual washing of the hands in preparation for eating of the parsley that's at the top of the plate, the bitter herbs. They will wash their hands. Remember, in the Jewish religion, ritual washing, even today, is still a big part of their practice. Dipping the carpus in salt water, remember, you have to have a bowl of salt water. This parsley symbolizes both the humble origin of the Jewish people as well as the rebirth of the spring. Now, this is an interesting piece of this. Remember how one plate, three pieces of matzah bread stacked on top of each other, wrapped in a napkin. They take the middle piece and they break it in half. And the larger piece, so when you break it, whichever piece ends up being larger, that becomes the aphikomen, if I'm saying that correctly. The aphikomen is considered to be the dessert. Okay? And that aphikomen, in some families, they will take it and they will hide it. And later, the children of the house will go seeking the aphikomen. Okay? It's like a hide and seek for their dessert. But the dessert is this piece of aphikomen, piece of matzah bread. All right? Number five, they will retell the Passover story. Remember, that's part of Exodus 12 and 13. When you observe this, tell your children, tell your family what happened, why we do this. And that includes the recital of the four questions and the drinking of the second cup of wine. Now, flip over to the back page of your handout. I have got the four questions listed. These are questions that are recited during the Passover meal. It is traditionally done by the youngest child, but can be done by anyone in the family. But here are the questions that are asked. The first question is this. The summary question is, why is this night different from all other nights? Like, why are we doing this? You know, why are we eating this meal in a different way than every other meal and every other night? And then they will ask the four questions. The four questions are this. On all other nights, we eat either bread or matzah. On this night, why only matzah? On all other nights, we eat herbs or vegetables of any kind. On this night, why bitter herbs? On all other nights, we do not dip even once. On this night, why do we dip twice? On all other nights, we eat our meals in any manner. On this night, why do we sit around the table together in a reclining position? And then the rest of the participants, so if it's the youngest child that's saying this, then everyone else will say in unison, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and God brought us out with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And if God had not brought our ancestors out of Egypt, we and our children's children would still be subjugated to Pharaoh in Egypt. Even if we were all old and wise and learned in Torah, we would still be commanded to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And the more we talk about the Exodus from Egypt, the more praiseworthy we are. So this is part of not just the retelling of what happened in the Passover, but they go through this ritual of stating these four questions and the reason why. And then part of this includes reading from the text, which is called Haggadah. And the Haggadah is a narrative of the Exodus story that combines elements of the Torah, the Mishnah, and the Talmud. Okay, so it takes all of those works, puts them together in this narrative story of the Exodus. That's why I want us to understand those texts, so you'd understand, you know, what we're talking about. But they will read that. Okay, then the sixth one, they will recite another blessing. They already had the second cup of wine. Remember, they will recite the blessing, and they will wash their hands, prepare to eat the matzah. They will recite another blessing, number seven. They will eat the matzah. In number eight, they pass it around. Blessing and eating of the marr, the bitter herbs. Then they will take the matzah that has been passed around, and they will make a sandwich out of it with matzah, marr, and charoset. And then 11 is where they actually eat a meal. Now, this is not the meal of the cedar plate. The cedar plate is part of the ceremony. They've been consuming of that all through here. But the meal is not the same in every family. Today, the meal could be fish. It could be brisket. It could be chicken. It could be matzo ball soup or all of the above. Okay. Remember, they don't have a Passover lamb to roast and eat, and so they will eat something else in substitute. They have the shank bone to represent the lamb on the plate, but they will have something else in their meal today. Now, when Jesus and his disciples observed Passover, the temple was still there. They would have had the Passover lamb, which would have been part of the Passover until AD 70. So they will have their meal. Then, in 12, this is where the children of the house will go find the aphikomen, the hidden half piece of matzah bread. It's bizarre, but that's what they do. And then they will recite another blessing, and they will drink the third cup of wine. And then at that point, the fourth cup is filled along with, if the family observes it, the cup for Elijah. Up until this point, Elijah's cup is empty. Then they will fill the cup for Elijah. The front door of the home is opened. That's what I mentioned earlier, to allow Elijah to enter. Number 14, recital of the Hallel. Traditionally recited on festivals, singing praises to God. And they will drink the fourth cup of wine. As they say, at the end of the meal and drinking the fourth cup of wine, they will recite from Exodus 6, 7, as we talked about earlier. And they will say, next year in Jerusalem. Why? Because what they are hoping for is the same thing that the Jews at the Wailing Wall we've talked about are hoping for, that the temple's going to be rebuilt on top of the Temple Mount where the Dome of the Rock is today, and they will be able to celebrate Passover in Jerusalem again. Okay, I know that was a lot. I thank you for hanging with me. But I realize that was dense. But I think, at least, even if you get a little bit of that, it helps to inform, you know, what we read about in the New Testament. Now, not all of that was being observed at the time of Jesus, but some of it was. I mean, it was a ceremonial meal. It was to have bitter herbs. It was to have unleavened bread, no leaven in the house. They were supposed to recite from the story of the Exodus to remind their children of the deliverance that God had given to them. And so, you know, this was a big deal. It is a big deal today. It is a big deal to Jews all over the world. And so a little bit of more understanding of what they do when they observe the Passover meal. As I said earlier, though, with all of these feasts and festivals, they are just a shadow of what was to come. You know, we read about in Exodus 12 and 13 that both the feast of Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you know, 8 total days. All of that was to be a, quote, permanent ordinance. So you may say, well, why don't we do it today? Well, it was intended to be, it was a shadow of what would ultimately be fulfilled with Jesus. Just the same way Sabbath was. So the Sabbath day was a shadow of what we ultimately receive through Jesus. Jesus is the one who has given us ultimate deliverance, not from a physical oppressor, but from Satan, from sin, so that we can be a part of God's kingdom. We have been given spiritual deliverance. And so these things that were a shadow of what we have now fully realized are no longer needed. We observe them in a different way. And one of the things we'll talk about next time is that Jesus took this and he changed it. He changed it to be an ordinance that was in memory of a physical deliverance to, hey, these are the elements that I want you to continue to use. And this is what it means to you now. And every time you take the bread and you take the cup, this is what it means to you now. We'll talk about that next week. But all of that was realized in Jesus, who is the only one who can deliver us spiritually. And if you're here tonight, I know this hasn't been a big gospel lesson, but the opportunity to respond to the gospel message is always there, that we fully realize in Jesus. And if you're here tonight and you've never accepted Jesus as your Savior, we encourage you to do that, to think about that. As always, if there's anything we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.